our sponsor, and there's then seen as ambush marketing and unfair competition and all these awful unethical practices that Olympic industry folks are so sensitive to. So then the right to play people are not allowed to have a presence in the Olympic Village, and they have in the past for a few decades now. Interestingly, from my perspective, the Olympic industry, and I use the word industry to draw attention to the fact that this is about profit making. This is a set of global corporations that are exemplify global capitalism. They're the ones that are getting rich, not the people in the host city or the host province or in the host country. So despite what I would consider many worse examples of the IOC and the Olympic industry in the last 10 years, some of my colleagues at the University of Toronto were finally prompted into action by this right to play example. How outrageous, they said to themselves, that the right to play, this children's charity that introduces sport to children in developing countries, how outrageous that they're not allowed to have a presence in the Olympic Village. So my colleagues at U of T are organizing a conference about that. Too bad that in 1998, the IOC, that it was made public around the world that the IOC had a long, long history of bribery and corruption in terms of the bid process. Too bad all the other ethical wrongdoings that IOC members and all their affiliates have been committing. Too bad about the atrocities that Olympic sponsors like Shell Oil have been committing. Finally, this one involving children, a charity, you know, these kind of magic words, has prompted them into action. And my position is that children have been victims, and men and women have been victims of the Olympic industry for decades. It's not a new phenomenon for children to, unfortunately, for children to be the victims. And Right to Play sounds like an organization like Motherhood that nobody would challenge. Interestingly, you know, way before this Right to Play example happened in Vancouver, a colleague of mine in the UK had written a critique of what he calls sentimental education. And without telling the whole critique, I thought it was an excellent and very valid argument, and I included this in a chapter on Olympic education in my new book, Olympic Industry Resistance. This colleague, Richard Giulianotti, said that this idea of exporting this product called sport, Western sport, into an African village, in other words, these very well-meaning but perhaps short-sighted individuals associated with Right to Play, firmly believe that the right to play is a basic human need, and are sometimes not addressing the more basic human needs. And Richard Giulianotti mentioned that sport shouldn't be embraced as a primary route to development and peace. It's not a magic solution to issues or problems in a small village in Africa. Bringing the football to the children in the small village in Africa does not solve disease, hunger, war, forced migration, housing homelessness problems, any of the big issues that confront the families in developing countries. And yet Right to Play is held up as this magic example, and you just, you know, drop the football into the village and the rest is history. In reality, if there is a talented young boy, and it won't be a girl, it'll be a boy, in South America or Africa, in a small village somewhere, and the Right to Play volunteer works his magic or her magic, and the child's football talent is identified, he'll end up playing for Manchester United or something. He won't be playing for Africa, because that exploitation of black athletes from Africa, particularly soccer, is very well documented. So this, again, you know, is one of these myths about sport, that it is pure and wholesome, and the Olympics are about pure and wholesome sport. They're not about politics. How many times have you heard people say, sport, politics has no place in sport, take the politics out of sport? All of us are bringing politics into sport as though it was never there in the beginning. And when journalists ask me that sort of thing, I say, the Olympics are about political because politicians are involved, because they are about the voting public, the polis, the population, because public money is being spent or poured down the drain quite often. Of course sport is political. It's a human endeavour. So just before I leave the university example, before I'm retired from the University of Toronto, but that doesn't mean I'm more outspoken. I think they were glad that I'm retired. university complicity in the Olympic industry is something that I've written a lot about that makes me angry. Olympic critics are silenced in the university despite the so-called academic freedom. So last summer we have the University of Toronto magazine, I've just brought the covers, but celebrating the Olympics, pages and pages of articles about university graduates or students who are part of the Olympics, mostly as athletes, some as coaches and officials. The Faculty of Physical Education and Health, well, not surprising, totally in bed with the Olympic industry. And I'm cross-appointed, or was cross-appointed to that faculty, so you can imagine how popular I was. Here's the cover, and again, wall-to-wall stories. And when I send them information about book releases, and I have three books on the Olympics, I'm lucky if it gets into these kinds of magazines. In fact, I don't think any of the announcements I've sent have ever been published in these two magazines. Every now and then they might be in an electronic newsletter, but they've blacklisted me from the electronic newsletter as well now. So here, as a contrast, Costco Connection. It's for Costco members. It's online as well as a paper version. Part of capitalism, profit-making sort of thing. So they wouldn't include information about people like me of critics and critical perspectives, would they? Well, there I am. They invited me to do a column, an opinion piece. The question is, do politics have a place at the Olympics? I was so-called expert in the field saying yes, politics have a place, and the Greek Deputy Minister of Culture, Giannis Ioannidis, did the no position, no argument, no politics don't have a place in the Olympics. So ironically, Costco was more balanced in the sense that they provided an opportunity for me to write, and the university publications don't and will continue not to, I'm quite sure. So I've documented the activities of groups that many of you are involved with in US, Canada, Australia, Europe, and I'm challenging words or terms like Olympic family, Olympic movement, Olympism, all these nice sounding words that sound almost religious. And when you see the hype around the torch, it's like the torch is a holy grail or something, you know, magical. There's all this pseudo-religious hype about it, and there's all the secrecy about the design of it, as though this is going to be an earth-shattering artistic symbol. It's not. It's just a flame. And all this thing about it shouldn't go out. Yeah, it's, as I said, a lot of hype. So
there's been a pattern, and Vancouver is typical, unfortunately. If we thought that Canada was sort of a more democratic and fairer and more just society than the US or Australia or, well, China is another category of countries, so I won't make those comparisons, but more, you know, gentler, kinder than recent host countries, and that Vancouver would do things differently. They're not, unfortunately. The idea of Olympics as a catalyst for development, not necessarily urban development since it's the Winter Games, but ski resort development, that's quite possible, probable. The poorest neighbourhoods are routinely targeted for development, and we see this in the downtown east side. Displacement of low-income residents, destruction of long-standing working-class communities. These are routine in Olympic host cities. And then all the benefits, the people who get richer are developers, resort and hotel owners, real estate industry, big business, the television networks, and so on. And the poor disproportionately bear the burden. And there's ample scholarship and documentation of the poor disproportionately bearing the burden around Olympics in general and around stadium construction in particular. And this is more relevant to summer games, but nevertheless it's typical. So we have situations with about half of Olympic budgets, or maybe more, being paid for with taxpayers' money, and tax increases persisting for decades, Montreal, underutilized facilities and infrastructure. And then there's this lovely idea of legacy, as if some gifts are dropping from the sky when you host the Olympics, a sort of a windfall profit of infrastructure and housing and sporting facilities. And they are, the public money isn't taken into account when people talk about legacy. So the bottom line is you get what you pay for, whether you want it or not. If you want a luge run in Whistler or a speed skating arena in Vancouver or a velodrome in Atlanta or a whitewater rafting course in London, whether the local residents want and need that kind of sporting facility or not, you have to have it because it's the Olympics. It's part of the blueprint, and that creates a problem that it might be a white elephant, very likely is. Sydney, Australia has a lot of white elephant venues, and the New South Wales government, the minute the Olympics left, started pouring millions of dollars into the area around Homebush Bay where all the stadiums were, to try to get them to be used because they've got an oversupply of stadiums now in Sydney. The big thing about Vancouver, the Sea to Sky Highway, this is something that Vanock and the politicians will say isn't an Olympic project. They'll say that, this was something that was needed, or make some other excuses to justify the taxpayers' money being used for this project. It may not be a bad idea to have the Sea to Sky Highway, but it's not necessarily, was not necessarily a top priority given the amount of billions of dollars that it will cost. So you sort of, they try to have it both ways of, and then sort of put it in under the radar as an Olympic project, whereas they must have been thinking about this way before the Olympics, and there's quite a high possibility that the development of the resorts was a big, there was a strong connection between those two. So, another kind of legacy, and this is a catchphrase, that having all these sparkling new facilities will be good for our children, that we'll have a whole generation who are inspired to take up speed skating or luge or whatever, because we've now got the facilities. And a colleague of mine in Sydney, in Australia, who actually was a member of the organising committee, she's an academic, Christine Toohey, and she was commissioned to write the report of the Sydney Olympics. So she, in many respects, had a vested interest. She was an insider and not very critical, but she recently presented a paper at the University of Toronto to see whether or not there really was an increase in sporting participation following Sydney 2000, because now so many communities had state-of-the-art sporting facilities and whole generation of children watched television or perhaps went to some events and got inspired and they had wonderful role models and so on and so on. So she wanted to see if that really produced increases in sporting participation. And she relied on two major surveys of participation across Australia. One was done by a private research company called the Sweeney Report, and the other was done by the Australian Sports Commission. And they both found that there was no increase in participation in the sports that were Olympic sports in Sydney 2000. There was some increases in something like attendance at fitness classes in local community centres, but not in Olympic sports. And there was greater passive involvement, so there were more people watching sport on TV after compared to before. Interestingly, the report that was published by the Australian Sports Commission, which is a bit like Sport Canada, you know, a big federal organisation, that was not made public. She got access to it. I asked her if she thought I would be able to get access to it. And she said, probably not. They suppressed it. She's a dean of a leisure department at an Australian university and has a lot of connections. So she got hold of this report and cited it in her paper. But that so-called legacy in Australia, which is a sports-mad country, I'm from Sydney, and I sort of know the mentality about sport. So, just moving on, and I probably don't have to tell you anything about Vancouver and Sam Sullivan and the Civil City Report and all that kind of thing, but just a few points. And to start with, you had the Inner City Inclusivity Statement, right? Part of the bid sounded beautiful, said that that would, you know, housing would be protected, people's rights would be protected, homeless people and so on. Then you have Sam Sullivan with the Civil City Report saying without evidence that there was a big increase in public disorder, and actually there was evidence to the contrary. There were successful community-based efforts to address poverty, homelessness and drug abuse, decreases in every major crime indicator in the preceding 10 years. And it was the nasty language in this report is probably one of the most offensive aspects of it, that there's a group called the public, and I don't think anyone in this room would be Sam Sullivan's the public, because the public are the tourists with money in their pockets, not the people with not much money or the people asking for money. They're not the public. So the people that the report demonised were homeless or had physical and mental health problems. They weren't the so-called law-abiding citizens, or particularly they weren't the Downtown Business Improvement Association people, because they were very concerned about urban decline, so-called. So this Civil City Report was trying to increase the public's sense of personal safety at the cost of other people's personal safety, namely homeless people. And it was very much like Atlanta, that homeless people were characterized as what I call urban vermin, literally. And the idea of making sure that dumpsters were locked so that homeless people couldn't get food out of dumpsters is very similar to Atlanta, where restaurant owners were told to pour bleach over the food that they dumped out the back of their restaurants. So it's just disgusting. I mean, it's beyond words, that kind of behavior. So literally, they're like rats. You know, they go through the garbage, and we want to deter them, so we do something about it. That was that was the tone, from my perception. That was the tone of that Civil City report. And then he wanted parking ticket enforcement people and garbage collectors to be the quote the new eyes and ears on the street to help local police and security officers. So you've got everybody surveilling homeless people and drug users and so on. So again, very similar. And Atlanta had the games in 1996. That's 13 years ago. And by 2000, there was almost complete privatization of downtown public space, formerly public space. The security officers were ticketing van drivers who were distributing food to homeless people in that area. And there were attempts, the mayor of Atlanta attempted to ban feeding the homeless in public on the grounds that it was a health hazard. And by 2006, nearly 70 Olympic cities had criminalized begging or lying down in public places, and 5 US cities had banned food distribution in public places. So, you know, that is a pattern that we've seen in a lot of host cities. In Sydney, because of the tireless work of anti-Olympic activists who belong to organizations like anti-poverty, homeless advocates, environmentalist, civil liberties, human rights organizations. They all work together, and the treatment of homeless people was nowhere near as bad as many of us had thought it would be in Sydney. A lot of people were moved out for a short period, but they were treated humanely. And the ones who stayed in the city, there was a homeless protocol put in place where volunteers from a bit like Pivot, legal aid organization, volunteers were in the police cars when they were patrolling streets and attempting to move on homeless people who were sleeping in public places. And they protected the rights. They got this through this homeless protocol that they worked on in collaboration with the police. In Sydney, not in the area outside of Sydney where the big venues were, but that was a big step. It was a huge step to get that homeless protocol in place. So the second half of my book, and just you'll recognize the cover, a squat in the downtown east side, and a banner says homeless, not games. And I love that photograph. Shane Caritco took it. So the first half of the book is pretty much what I've just been talking about for the last several minutes. The Vancouver, Toronto's bid process, events in London, some coverage of Beijing, events in Salt Lake City, and it's so repetitive, really. It's the same thing over and over again. So in the second half of the book, I wanted to come at the problem from a different angle, and not just talking about generating consensus, manufacturing consent through the media, through ideologies, that kind of thing, through the huge media machine that the Olympic industry has, that makes people think, Olympic goosebumps effect. I hear it often. The first time I heard it was from a former Olympic athlete who said he got goosebumps in Calgary during the Winter Games, at some stage of things. I don't know what it was. They don't usually have much to do with sport. The Goosebumps effect is sort of the watching the opening ceremonies or something like that. It escapes me, but then not surprising. So I wanted to come at it from the angle of education, because I've been an educator all my adult life, first early childhood and then elementary school and then university from 1986. So I wanted to see what role education plays. And I looked at this idea of role models that is such a favorite. You know, Olympics and role models, sport and role models. You don't see sort of the combination professional violinist and role model, or activist and role model. You see, celebrity athlete. And I looked at a lot of the coverage sort of via the internet and what some of my academic colleagues have written about it, critical stuff. And it seems that that's one very significant way that the Olympic industry gets into the heads of children, through promoting Olympic role models. And the Canadian Olympic Committee, for a small fee, will send an Olympic hopeful. They've got a registry of about 500 or something Olympic hopefuls. And if you're a teacher, you could get one of these people to come to your class or your school and show their medals and show them the video of them in the finals getting a medal, so on, and getting, so that person talks to the kids, gives them a motivational speech, and the throw into this equation the fact that in the US in particular, but in Canada as well, there's a big emphasis on black celebrity role models. So you've got that other variable thrown in that, and there've been, I just read a wonderful book by a black sports journalist from the US, Sean Powell, and the book's called Sold Out, S-O-U-L-E-D, Out. And he is one of many voices saying, why are we as black people, parents, leaders, activists, journalists, why are the only people that we're holding up as positive examples for our children, why are they only celebrity athletes? Are we saying that that's the only thing a black child can be, that they can't be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, an astronaut or whatever, they're just the athlete thing is obviously a racist message somewhere in there. And the problem with any athlete, and I'm any professional athlete, well, any celebrity athlete, let's say, forget about the skin color, is that many of them, like Charles Buck, he said he didn't sign up to be a role model, and that's fair enough. They signed up to do the sport, not to be positive examples for children necessarily. And as another critic, an academic critic, said, trouble is the guy you have in your classroom on Friday might show up on Saturday's TV news getting carted off in handcuffs because he just beat up his girlfriend, took drugs, somebody springs to mind, did something that was law-breaking or skirting the law. And, okay, they're human, and why did we think that they might be good examples on every front? But the Canadian Olympic Committee and a group called Sport Matters, which is connected with the Canadian Olympic Committee, and all these kind of liberal initiatives, they tend to say, the Michael Phelps of the world will role models for children in sport and in life. It's a huge leap. Why should they be positive examples in life? They show obsessive personalities. You have to be an Olympic athlete.
you probably have to be a university professor too. You have to have a big ego. You are not sort of a well-rounded individual necessarily, because you can't be if you're training to be an Olympic competitor. There's so many obvious shortcomings. Whereas if we're talking about a positive example, a role model for sport, your kid's coach or your kid's teacher at school or the neighbour who is a good example because she runs around, you know, she runs 3K every morning before work or something. There are plenty, or, you know, family members, there are plenty of positive examples for children who are accessible, who have a place in children's everyday lives. And that's my argument, is that that's, and based on the research that I've quoted in the book, these are the people who make a difference in children's lives, not the one on TV or the one who parachutes into the classroom and Van Cuverden, for example, said how great it was that all the kids screamed when they saw this video of him crossing the finish line. That wasn't Beijing, that must have been the ones before. You know, so what? How does that change a child's life? What changes the child's life is that their parents or their teachers or their people in their church or in their neighbourhood are showing them that sport and physical activity are fun things to do, that winning isn't everything. In fact, it's, you know, just a bit of it. You know, I wouldn't say winning is nothing, but it's not everything. So many other men and women in the community who can be inspirations to kids. So forget celebrity role models. I think they're passé. They're not going to live up to their reputations. And one after the other, we see they have feet of clay. And why shouldn't they, really? It's they're often built up by their corporate sponsors too. That's why they get the kind of prominence that they get. So, just to finish up, if you're wondering where I was going with all of this, I'll just read a short list of recommendations that are on the last page of the book. On the last page of my first book, I called, and that was released in 2000, Inside the Olympic Industry, Power, Politics and Activism, I called for the dismantling of the Olympic industry, for what good it did, but that's what I wanted. I said that people who love sport and care about social justice, and there are people who do both, should be directing their energies to other international sporting competition that doesn't have the horrendous reputation of the Olympics, isn't tainted with all those negatives that the Olympics has. I don't see that it has to be the Olympics. It's not literally not the only game in town, given that there's Pan Am, Commonwealth, Gay Games, University Games, or at local levels. You know, if children or adults want competition, there's a lot of other options. So basically a boycott of the Olympics, that would be a good start. In this book I say, and these are more sort of liberal approaches, I'm all for a range of approaches, including radical, including direct action, but that's... you know, and a lot of us in Bread Not Circuses, you know, sort of got a few leaked things and spread them and that kind of thing, and that works. The same in Sydney too. There was a nice leak that I was connected with around one university spending quite a few million dollars on a corporate box, and they were going to invite their donors and their, you know, all the people who gave big money to the university. The corporate box was for their use, not for anybody at a lower level. It was for friends, sort of to return favors to friends. And that got leaked to one of the most right-wing newspapers in Sydney, you know, who hate rich folk,
not because of class hatred, but they just, you know, they just had a ball with that. They're probably sort of anti-university too, so it worked out quite nicely. They did a big story out of it. So, lobbying elected politicians at every level, supporting local government candidates who run on Olympic watchdog or an anti-Olympic bid platform, and I know that's had its ups and downs in Vancouver because there was a group with that platform and then their numbers kind of got decimated and here we are. Demanding responsible investigative journalism on the part of mainstream media, supporting and participating in independent media websites to circulate alternative views and visions, peaceful protests, non-violent direct action, supporting whistleblowers within every sector of the Olympic industry, boycotting Olympic sponsors and telling them why, working with public intellectuals, lobbying school boards to screen Olympic education materials, developing community-based alternatives to the Olympic role model approach, and refusing to allow children and youth to be exploited by the Olympic industry. And you see, you know, the kind of the children who are part of opening closing ceremonies or who went with the bid committee or whatever. Sadly, in Australia, Canada, elsewhere, Indigenous people are exploited for the singing and dancing side, the cultural side, to sort of embellish the bid with some cultural content that is tokenistic and just looks as if it's inclusive of Indigenous peoples, and it's not. And that is a pattern and that we've seen, as I said, Australia did it, Canada's done it many, many times. England, London, didn't have an Indigenous population, but they had an immigrant population. So they scooped up some Indian and Pakistani kids and took them to the IOC meeting where the bids were presented, which is just, you know, as bad. It's the same thing as the exploiting Indigenous children or any other minority just for their purposes. So I will stop now. I could go on all night, but my voice will give out anyway. So over to you to ask questions and comments.
Yes, sure. Okay, so we're just going to have Gord up first and then have a bigger question period at the end.
Luisa Gila Castle. My name is Gordy Hill. I'm from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation, and I'm involved with the Olympic Resistance Network. We're the ones who organized this forum, and I run the no2010.com website, if you want to check that out, because we update it regularly, and it's got a lot of different information on there, photo galleries and videos and stuff. first, I'd just like to acknowledge we're on Kosage territory. Thank their ancestors for allowing us to be here to gather and talk about this thing that's going to impact the land here. I'd like to thank Helen for coming to speak at the forum, and also for all the work that she did writing those books and all the research and stuff. Because when we started to try to look at what the Olympics were and that was a real important source of information for us, was the books that Helen wrote. Because there was, when we were looking at what the Olympics were, trying to understand it and comprehend it, there's like not a whole lot of information out there to do that through, right? So her book's really important. And another aspect about her books was that she talked about the Aboriginal component in the Olympics in Sydney 2000. And so that was something that we learned a lot from, because it's a similar situation. It's the same kind of colonial country, right? Australia, Canada, it's pretty much the same thing, right? Part of the Commonwealth and all that kind of stuff. Same kind of land struggle, same kind of conditions for Aboriginal people there. So it was a really good thing to learn from, and to look at how their government-funded Aboriginal groups worked to co-opt and undermine the grassroots Indigenous resistance that arose there. So I'd just like to thank Helen. Hey. I was going to just talk kind of briefly. I was going to run through our top 10 anti-2010 list to update people. It's a leaflet here. There's a couple of versions of it. One's from Olympic Resistance Network, and this one's from no2010.com. It helps me to go through it because it's a very large-scale industry, the Olympic industry, right? Which, and again, that's thanks to Helen, I think, that we kind of got the message that this thing was an industry, a multi-billion dollar industry. But anyway, so it's a very large-scale industry, and it has very large impacts on many, many people and on very large area regions of a country, right? So it's a very big, big thing. That's why in our movement, anti-Olympic movement and the Olympic Resistance Network, it's a very diverse coalition, right? People who are opposing the Olympics come from many different backgrounds. So anyway, the top 10 thing is, the first one we have is the colonial and fascist history of the Olympic industry. So when we look into the history of it, we looked at one of the founding members of what's called the modern Olympics was a French baron, Pierre Coubertin, and he used sports, he saw sports as a means of strengthening and advancing colonialism. And there's some very good quotes from him where he says it's a good way of making the colonized people appear like, he's countering this idea that, oh, if the colonized participate in these sports and they win, it might lead to rebellion. And then his thing was, no, it's actually a good thing because it makes them feel like they're victorious and that the Western system works and that they can participate in it. Anyway, he's got all these other quotes in it. They're very revealing about his attitude about the sports and Olympics. And if we look at some of the different Olympic Games and that, their association with these colonial fascist elites, the most obvious example would be, does anybody want to guess? Hitler's 1936 Olympics, the Nazi Olympics, which really helped strengthen the fascist regime in Germany. They initiated the torch relay as a way of spreading fascism through Western Europe and throughout Germany. During the games, they kind of whitewashed Berlin, got rid of all the anti-Jewish slogans that the stormtroopers had been painting. They kind of didn't talk about the concentration camps that were up and running at that time, where there was hundreds, thousands of Jews and communists and gays and different social elements that the Nazis thought were vermin, you know, as Helen mentioned. The same kind of attitude that they have, these elite. So anyway, while these concentration camps were running, you know, Jewish groups organized a boycott of the Olympic Games at that time. But one of the strongest opponents of it was a man called Avery Brundage, who was involved in the U.S. Olympic Committee, their national Olympic organization, and he actively undermined the boycott and just dismissed it all as a Jewish communist conspiracy. During World War II, he was kicked out of the America First Committee for his pro-Nazi attitude, his sympathies, and he ended up becoming the president of the IOC for many, many years. Another well-known fascist associated with the IOC, and there's a very long list of these guys, right? Italians and Germans and French Nazi collaborators during World War II who were still on the IOC after the war. But anyway, one of the most well-known is Samaranch, that's his last name, he's from Spain, and he was a governor in Catalonia under the Franco regime, which, as you may know, was also a fascist regime in Spain. So, and he was president for decades as well, right? Another Olympic Games we could look at is the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, where there is at least 300 student protesters were massacred by the government just days before the Olympic Games were to begin. Some estimates are that there was like 1,000 people killed. And one of the one of the police military units that participated in this massacre of this against this huge student mobilization protest movement that was developed in Mexico City, one of the special police military units was the Olympia Battalion. And they were the ones who initiated the shooting that caused all these deaths to occur. The IOC had nothing to say about this except to say that the Mexican government had assured the IOC that the games would proceed peacefully and they would not be interrupted. That's the only comment they had to make about this massacre. And if you may remember, there's another important thing that happened in Mexico City that may be more well known. Does anybody hazard a guess about what that might be? Yeah, the two black U.S. athletes, they won the 100-meter dash or something. They won the gold and silver, and when they got up on the podium, they raised their hands in a Black Power fist salute. And, world attention was focused on them. And it's very revealing because of the response from the IOC towards this small political gesture was to use the heaviest sanctions that the IOC could use, which was to strip them of their medals and have them evicted from the games. So you can see like where their priorities are, you know, where their sympathies really are, right? Hundreds of people are killed. They have nothing to say about that. But two athletes do a political protest and they kick them out of the games. Anyway, that's enough about colonialism, fascism, Olympics. The second thing we talk about is the No Olympics on Stolen Native Land. And we talk about that because here in BC, you may or may not be aware of, there's virtually no treaties for the sovereign indigenous lands that are here. And this is contrary to the British and Canadian law, which required settler governments and businesses to acquire treaties before any trade or settlement could occur. And as you may know, across Canada, the government did this, and they're very large tracts of land were treated for. They call them the numbered treaties, like Treaty Number 1, Treaty Number 4, etc. All through the prairies, you have these treaties. Once you get to British Columbia, there's no treaties, except for a few on Vancouver Island, and in the northeast portion of the province. It's a part of Treaty Number 8. So what happened in BC was the first governor of the province, who was the head of the Hudson's Bay Company, because the Hudson's Bay Company was the first colonial government in the province here, and it's one of the major corporate sponsors for the Olympics, right? Anyway, what happened there was Governor Douglas made those treaties on Vancouver Island, and then they suspended the treaty-making deals, saying that there wasn't enough money to do this, and they just carried on, and they allocated reserve lands to indigenous peoples. In 1875, the BC government passed a Lands Act to open up more land to settlement. And the federal government passed a duty of disallowance, saying and striking down this provincial law and saying that this is it's illegal because you have not acquired the legal surrender of indigenous lands. And BC threatened to withdraw from Confederation at this time. And then in 1876, the government passed the Indian Act, which is a federal law that covers all indigenous peoples in the country. And this is how the reserve system, the band council system, and the status system were imposed on indigenous peoples. And when the federal government did that, they assumed and imposed their control over native peoples and lands here in the province. So the illegal law that BC had passed, the Lands Act, was allowed to stand. And their illegal occupation and settlement of indigenous lands continues to this day. So our position is that the government lacks the legal or moral authority to govern in this land. That's No Olympics on Stolen Land, and we use that slogan to raise people's consciousness about the history of colonization in the province here, and to raise the anti-colonial consciousness in particular, right? To show that they lack that legal and moral authority to govern. The third thing we have to talk about on our top 10 list is the ecological destruction that's accompanied these Olympic Games. There's a very large-scale environmental impact that's not really talked about. A little bit is the Sea to Sky Highway, a massive infrastructure expansion that they've done there, almost $1 billion worth, and they've blasted and logged and just destroyed a whole section of the forest all the way up to Whistler. And then in Whistler themselves, they've built the new ski centers and ski trails and stuff like that. They cut upwards of 100,000 trees, you know. If you remember that big storm we had here in the city in 2006, I think it was, there was like all those trees were knocked down in Stanley Park, and there was a big public outcry, like, oh, how terrible. Well, if you compare the scale of the destruction, that was like, I think that was about 10,000 trees that were knocked down during that windstorm. And it was pretty devastating in Stanley Park there. So you can imagine, almost 100,000 trees are cut down up in Whistler to make more skiing venues and stuff like that. Another aspect of the environmental impact is all the concrete that they're producing to make these venues and highway improvements and stuff and new bridges and that, right? And all this concrete's got to come from somewhere. Where do you think it comes from? It just appears in those big trucks and they mix it up. It comes from the land. And that this construction crazed city is dredging up all the local rivers and wherever they can get gravel and sand. So they're digging up the Fraser River. In 2006, one of these quarry operations killed like 2 million salmon. One of the runs was devastated by this mining of the rivers there. So that's just some of the main environmental impacts that we talk about to raise people's awareness about it. Because, you know, the Olympic industry here, VanOck and the IOC, they're talking about the green games, sustainability. It's all lies, right? That's one thing we've come to realize, is it's all lies, and it's just to fool people into accepting their propaganda. The fourth thing was homelessness, which Helen talked a little bit about. Since 2002, when Vancouver won the bid, we've seen a 370% increase in homelessness. Hundreds of low-income housing has been lost in the downtown east side. But still, Vanhoek and them are running around talking about sustainability and all the social housing they're building. And you just see what they're doing. It's just these piddly little amounts, like 10 here, 10 there. A lot of them outside the city. A bunch of them were those temporary housing construction things they're building for the workers that they're going to distribute after the games to house the homeless. These kinds of tokenistic actions. But one thing I'll say about that is the government wouldn't even be doing that if people hadn't been out in the streets over the last couple of years fighting against this, against that, and raising awareness about these issues and taking direct action. We would have way less social housing now, and the conditions here would be even worse. So that's something that people who deride our methods or who say we don't accomplish anything should consider, because we actually have fought for the last couple of years, a lot of different community groups, to protect what is left here and to stop this, the scale of the impact could be far larger if we weren't doing something about it. The criminalization of the poor is another important thing that's going on, where the government and the police and the corporations, the business elite, are saying that the poor are just a criminal element and they have to be dealt with. So we have these things like Civil City and the Safe Streets Act. And right now there's a very increased police harassment of the poor in the downtown area. They're trying to ticket people and trying to push them out of the downtown East Side area. So that's another aspect of this Olympic industry. Impact on women. One thing that's not really discussed about is the impact of these mega sporting type of events on women. A couple years ago, there was a large football tournament in Germany, and the European Parliament and women's groups began to organize around it to try to raise awareness over there about the impact of these types of events on women. Because what happened was there was a mass explosion in trafficking of women for these games, and there was tens of thousands of women, trafficked women, who were brought in to service this tourist industry, this tourist market, which accompanies these kinds of games, right? And if you consider here in Vancouver, the recent history of the conditions for women in the downtown East Side with all the missing and murdered women, you know, there's like over 70 missing and murdered women here. All kinds of violence and assaults against poor women and indigenous women who are overrepresented in, on the streets there. We got this missing and murdered women's case down here, and then up on Highway 16, you may have heard the Highway of Tears. There's at least 30 missing or murdered young women along that highway. Many of them are also Native. So these kinds of concerns are very real when you think about this mass tourist market and the potential for criminal gangs to organize themselves and try to profit, and one through drugs and prostitution. And we can see right now in Vancouver this gang war that's going on, where they're fighting for power and territory or whatever they're doing, but they're killing one another. And you can only imagine all the money that's at stake and what it's going to be like in 2010, a year from now, when you see these power struggles going on now and their involvement in these kinds of illicit markets. Anyway, 2010 police state, number 7. 2010 police state, right now they're conducting Exercise Silver. The Canadian Forces, the RCMP, the Vancouver Police, all these different police forces and emergency services. There's about 1,000 of them in town, in the city right now, conducting these exercise training. And one of the purposes of that is to try to intimidate and put fear into the social movements who are opposed to the Olympics. And the other thing is to try to justify this massive, almost $1 billion they're spending on security for these games, right? And the other aspect of that, besides trying to terrorize the opposition, is to try to make the rest of the population feel like the government's in control. Because what it is, it's like a demonstration of state power, which is what all these kind of spectacles are in a sense, right? Like they're building huge pyramids. And this is another version of the pyramid, where it's like a demonstration of, look how powerful and rich we are, we can do this, and this kind of stuff, right? So anyway, during the 2010, they are expecting to have about 12,500 soldiers and police. The RCMP is in charge of overall security, and they've established the Integrated Security Unit. And one of the things they've been doing over the last year or year and a half is issuing these reports, the RCMP and the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, issuing reports about the great danger that the games are faced with from all these different elements, including the domestic protests, which is like our movements, right? They're saying we're a big security threat, so they're going to need all these police and stuff like that. One of the things that they've been doing, besides issuing these security threat assessment warnings or whatever, is they're going around interviewing, trying to interview people, trying to interrogate people, and they're trying to recruit informants from within our movement so that they could, you know, spy on us and stuff like that and disrupt our organizing, which is mostly based around public education, right? So this kind of thing is going on right now, so we have put out statements about that, advising people not to talk with the police, not to collaborate with them, because they're not here to help us. They're here to help the rich and powerful who are organizing the Olympics and who are the ones to gain and profit from it, right? So our thing is to stand in solidarity with people who are being affected by these games and not to collaborate with the police, right? The public debt, number eight, the massive public debt, which has been very much in the news the last few months with the economic crisis, the decline, and the Olympic Village, which... I seen a really good poster of, it's got the headline, you know, Olympic bailout for the, and it said, and someone had stenciled Olympic pillage underneath it. So I thought, that's a very good term for what that village is. You know, it's like a new name for it, the Olympic pillage, official athletes Olympic pillage. Down there, you know, now the city is basically on the hook for almost $1 billion for this facility. I don't know if you've been down there, you take a look at it, it's a very, very large condominium complex type of thing they're building down there, right? And one of the along with that, you know, that's, you know, the Van Ocka number saying these games are going to cost like $600 million or something like that. And a lot of it's going to be paid for through corporate sponsorship and all that. But as Helen mentioned, they don't factor in all these other costs that are a part of winning the bid, as it was termed back before 2002, when we actually did win the bid, right? Like all these infrastructure projects that the IOC demanded, Van Ock and the city say that they were to build them by the time 2010, right? The Sea to Sky Highway expansion was one. The IOC was very concerned about that highway because of how narrow it is and how the rock slides and stuff like that. Well, you can see they've been constructing for the last couple of years, and you can see they've been hit with probably some of the biggest landslides and rock slides in the history of the highway. So that's another hidden Olympic cost, as they call it. The $1 billion for security, they don't include that in any Van Ock budget, because that's going to be paid for by the federal and provincial governments. Then you got the Vancouver Convention Center. It's another almost $1 billion for that. The RAV line out to the airport, the SkyTrain thing, which they said, well, we need this for the 2010 Olympics and all that kind of stuff. So that's like $2 billion. The whole cost of it, which was in the Vancouver Sun a couple weeks ago, a big headline, $6 billion, right? At least $6 billion public debt for the 2010 Olympic Games. But they're still saying, you know, $670 million or something like that. Because they just lie. Like I was saying, right? They just straight lie to the people. And a lot of people just kind of believe them because they have this thing. They're raised since they're a little child. What a great, glorious thing the Olympic Games are. And it is this pseudo-religious thing that they surround it with that just kind of bedazzles people. And they come away with this thing, like, what a great thing. There could possibly nothing be bad about the Olympics. Well, that's what our movement is trying to say. Like, hey, there's some big, serious problems with these games, and they have a lot of negative impacts on these things. Olympic corruption is another aspect of the Olympic industry. All the bribes, the scandals that have hit the IOC. Salt Lake City was one of the biggest ones. Some of those IOC officials were dismissed or quit in disgrace. They're being investigated by the U.S. federal government and stuff. And, you know, that's pretty serious because you got the U.S. federal government's going to investigate you because they don't really investigate, you know, business corruption as such. So that was a big controversy hit the IOC. All the way into Japan, all these different Olympic games where there's all these bribery scandals and stuff going on. And then, of course, there's a whole thing about drugs and the athletes. And not just Phelps smoking a bong, but like these guys taking steroids and all these all kinds of different drugs to enhance their performance because they're so competitive. I mean, the Olympics is a perfect thing for like the capitalist mentality just transferred into sports, where they're just going to win at any cost, they're going to cheat, they're going to lie to get the, you know, whatever, to get the gold medal, to get the contracts, to get their careers going, or whatever is going through their brains, these athletes, because not much else appears to be when, you know, you're trying to say, like, hey, there's some problems with the games, and they're just like, I'm just an athlete, you know, I'm just here to compete. Corporate invasion is number 10. Now, the corporate invasion is something that accompanies these Olympic industries because the government and the corporations use them, Olympic leverage, they call it, to try, to spotlight an area, to draw in corporate investment. So they come to BC, and what the BC government has done is it's relaxed a lot of taxes and licensing arrangements and stuff. So now it's easier for the corporations to do business in a few different industries like mining, oil and gas, and the ski resort industries are the main ones that they've really targeted. And so we say they have these investment to 2010 strategies, the Asia Pacific Gateway strategy, which are all about creating new infrastructure, new railroads, bridges, pipelines, these kinds of port facilities, all these things. You've probably heard about them. They're all in the news. They're all interconnected because they're part of this strategy to increase the ability for corporations to come in and do resource exploitation, right? And they've got these huge markets: Asia, China, and the United States. And this is where a lot of these resources are going to, right? And so this is why we say the 2010 Olympics, the four host First Nations can't get up and say, we think it's okay, Olympics come here, it's in our territory, and we're going to give the okay to it. Because it doesn't just impact the four host First Nations, it impacts the whole province, it impacts all the indigenous people who are trying to stop all these destructive mining, oil and gas projects and that, right? So, on that note, the four host First Nations, it should be keep in mind, are, Squamish, the Lillooet, the Tsleil-Waututh, and the Musqueam, whose traditional territories we are on right now, right? Except for the Lillooet, because they're up near near Whistler, right? Now, the thing about these four host First Nations is their population is about 6,000 or 7,000 Native people, right? Now, the population of Vancouver, Metro Vancouver, Native population, is estimated to be about 65,000, and probably more than that, right? So, the four host First Nations, they're getting tens of millions of dollars from the government, they're getting land deals, they're getting contracts for some of this logging and stuff that's going on, and I'm sure some of their members are obviously benefiting from it, especially their chief and council, their band councils, right? However, if they try to portray that as being to the benefit of all Native people, but that's not true, because if there are only 6,000 or 7,000 people, and that you have a Native population of 65,000, well, the majority of the Native people here aren't benefiting from the Olympics, and if anything, they're with the rest of the population that are losing and experiencing a negative impact from the Olympics. Like, if you consider the homelessness, as I mentioned earlier, almost 40% of the people on the streets here in the city are Native. So how are the four host First Nations helping all the rest of the Native people in the city and in the province? Well, the answer is they're not. And their band councils are nothing but government collaborators and with the corporations, and they're just a part of this money-making industry too, right? And they're allowing themselves to be used and manipulated, and they're recruiting all these naive, young, Native artists and musicians and whatever to participate in it, and to portray themselves, and to portray Canada as having a just and harmonious relationship with Native people, which is false, right? Anyway, back to those corporations. So some of the major corporate sponsors, if you look at them, are Royal Bank of Canada, Petro-Canada, Bombardier, General Motors, General Electric, Dow Chemical, the DuPont. These are like some of the major McDonald's, Coca-Cola. These are large multinational corporations. A lot of them are involved in widespread environmental destruction all around the world. Coca-Cola factories are renowned for their toxic waste and depleting water sources in Central America and Asia. They've been connected with death squads, paramilitary death squads that go and kill and torture union leaders and members who are trying to organize in these Coca-Cola plants. And they're one of the main sponsors for the 2010 Torch Relay. You got McDonald's, just all these corporations, right? And these are the types of people the four host First Nations are getting in bed with, These are the people they want to help and work with. So that just shows you where their mentality is, No, it's not about the people. They want to be with these big corporations that are causing all kinds of environmental destruction, human rights violations, major parts of the war industry, the General Electric, General Motors. They're the ones who make all the armored personnel carriers that are now deployed in Afghanistan, and some of which will be deployed here. that's the top 10. The top 10 kind of main things that we focus on. because like I said, it's a very large-scale impact from the Olympic Games, right?
What about all the security cameras?
Yeah, CCTV, security cameras, RCMP, you're going to get those and all that kind of stuff. Yep. So I'll just talk a little bit about the Olympic Resistance Network. We're, like I said, we're a coalition of different groups, and we organize these public educational events like forums and protests and that. We are having a large protest this February 12th, which is the one-year countdown to 2010. Vanock and them have organized their own events, the Cultural Olympiad and stuff like that. But we're going to have a torchlight parade because, you know, they can run a torch through the cities. They can run torches all around the world through cities with streets lined with thousands of people. So we can have a torch, and we can go through the streets of our city with a torch as well, right? So we're going to have a torchlight parade, and we invite everybody to come down because we want to shine some light on the negative impacts of the Olympic industry. And it's at 6 o'clock on February 12th, which is this Thursday, at Victory Square, which is at Cambie and Hastings, right? Some of the recent stuff we've done as the Olympic Resistance Network is we've established contact and liaison with groups in Tokyo and Chicago, which are facing the 2016 Olympic Games. There's city governments and the usual crew of businessmen and realtors and tourism and construction company pirates are in those cities, are organizing to try to get the Olympic Games into their cities. So their community groups have begun organizing. So we've had we've exchanged statements with them and information on that. One of our members and a member of the Games Watch 2010, Chris Shaw, was recently in Chicago, where he participated in a large public forum where they're beginning to organize opposition to this bid process. And another friend of ours was in Tokyo, and he helped translate some of the materials, the information, because they have a No Games Tokyo, where they're going to try to stop that the similar bid process there, right? Because this Olympic industry just hops from city to city. And what happened with a lot of us, at least with me, was we were kind of caught unprepared. We didn't really understand or comprehend what the Olympics were. And if we had known, we would have done a lot more to oppose the bid process. Unfortunately, we didn't. So we're just trying to make the best out of the situation and to, you know, use it to raise awareness and to try to involve more people in the social movements for justice, right? As I said, I help maintain the no2010.com website, and there's stickers and t-shirts at the back you can buy. Or the stickers are free, but the t-shirts, $15 to $20, you can buy to help support our work. And there's also a sign-up sheet for the Olympic Resistance Network if you'd like to be informed of upcoming events and that, because we're going to be organizing you know, forums and concerts and stuff all the way through up until 2010. And in February of 2010, we called for a large gathering and mobilization of people here to resist and to disrupt the 2010 Olympics. And it begins February 10th, 2010, and it runs to the 15th. So that is the main thing that we're promoting, as well as the protest against the torch relay, which begins October 30th, 2009, in Victoria. And it's going to go all, it's got this convoluted route. It goes up north and then goes across the country and then comes back this way. So we are going to be organizing protests in all these different cities and stuff like that. Eh? So anyway, with that, thank you for listening to me. And I'd like to thank Helen again. And I'll pass it back to the moderator, I guess.
Thanks a lot. Before we begin with the question period, I'd just ask if there's any law enforcement in the crowd, if you could please identify yourself. No? Okay, just to let people know, if people were noticing the disruption in the back, we identified and removed a member of the North Van Profiling Unit, who's with the Vancouver Integrated Security Unit. So we're just asking if there's anyone else here now to let us know. Okay, great, thank you. So we'll now just open the space up for questions for Gord and Helen. If you just want to raise your hand, I'll keep a speakers list.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask why there was no mention of cutbacks in healthcare, education, social services, and also why there wasn't any mention of the relationship of the Olympics to jobs. And actual cutbacks in jobs of all sorts, and low-paying jobs because of the minimum wage.
can answer that. I can answer that. I think you just did. There is some of our information that talks about the labor issues, like the contract stuff that they signed to get the Olympic peace, the immigrant labor, problems with the immigrant labor. They're being exploited for, cheap wages and stuff like that. So those things are, I had to focus on things, top 10 list. Yeah, like I said, there's a big impact of this kind of stuff. And it's good that you mentioned that.
Hi, my name's Susan, and I wanted to ask about the recent bylaws the city enacted and how we may counter them, or what we're up against with the no protest signage and all that. Are they enacted immediately? Does anyone know?
I do not believe they are enacted immediately. They are just going through the process, and because they got it. I'm not sure, but they got to change the charter or something, so it's going to take a little while. What they voted on to do was to do that, though, was to go through this thing of changing the charter. And because if you don't know, the city council is trying to amend the city charter or something to change the bylaw about illegal signage. And the rationale they're using is that the VANOC and the IOC and the Olympic corporations want this signage bylaw changed so they can almost immediately, within an hour or something, with very short notice anyway, go into a residence or a building or whatever and remove what they call illegal signage. And what they're saying is it would be like corporate advertising that's not sponsors of the Olympics and that. And they're also increasing the fine from $50 to $10,000 or something like that. So the concern is that this is going to impact illegal signage being anti-Olympic messages. So there's always that potential. But city council assured us. So we can only go by their word. Yeah, I think that's happened in other Olympics too. They clamped down on public messaging, closed down websites and during Sydney 2000, copyright infringement, they say, and stuff like that. So.
You mentioned that the taxpayer is going to be $6 billion in debt over this. If you're interested in it so far, what kind of money are we talking about? Who are they walking over on the agenda?
No one really knows the answer to that. Olympic budgets are very creative. So they'll put indirect costs, they'll ignore indirect costs on that side of the page, and they'll put in indirect benefits on the plus side of the page. So you end up not seeing, for example, security budgets or things that they say were going to happen anyway, so we won't put them down there. So they'll, as I was saying with the Sea to Sky Highway, there's no doubt an argument that it's not Olympic related, so it doesn't go in the budget because residents of BC benefit from it in the long term. And then on the other hand, it just pops up in time for the Olympics. So it's really hard to know. We know who gets the big profits, who makes the profits. And then there is an amount of money, and it varies, but the IOC gives a whole city an amount of money, which is part of the sort of incentive to host the games. There's an amount that's just given, but it's used up very, very quickly in the big scheme of things because of the huge budgets, the billions that are involved. So it's really, we don't know. We can see from Montreal, we get a pretty good example from Montreal of what the deficit was. So I think that's the best thing to go on. It's going to be on that side.
Are you more concerned with not the debt, but the profits?
Yeah, well, that's veiled in secrecy, really. I don't think anyone could say the answer, but maybe you know more about profits.
It's spectacular. I couldn't even begin to comprehend profits.
Chris Shaw's book's got a pretty good outlay on that.
Yes, yeah, that's a good point.
What are the strategies that they used in the Sydney Games to nullify or divide the protesters so that
I remember during the games themselves, there weren't that many protesters in Sydney. What did the police do so that we would know over here, what, is there something we can expect?
Well, there were such stringent rules about where protests could or couldn't take place. And I just saw in today's paper in Vancouver that there are areas called live sites where there'll be jumbo screens and live film of Olympic events in Whistler, for example. And if you designate some live sites and you add to that the downtown, the Vancouver venues, it's harder to do with Vancouver and Whistler because they're miles apart, but I'll give the example of Sydney. You had Homebush Bay, 16 kilometres from the downtown. You had all of that, an Olympic site. Downtown and in the suburbs, you had things like Bondi Beach, beach volleyball, yachting on the harbour, that kind of thing. I drew circles on a map, and then a big public areas like plazas and squares in the downtown with the jumbo screens, they were called live sites. There were about 8 or 10 of them, I think. In effect, it blanketed the city with Olympic venues, and then all the legislation about no protest in or near Olympic venues applied to vast, vast areas of the city and suburbs. So that was a ploy, I think, in my mind, to make sure that the security could enforce this legislation, not just in or near a venue, which is what the IOC requires, but use it as an excuse to clamp down on protest and homeless people sleeping overnight in certain areas across the city and across big chunks of the suburbs. So I don't know what the strategy for that is. Just back to your question, though, there was a big Indigenous Aboriginal protest planned that didn't materialise because of a lot of internal discussions that I wasn't part of, obviously, and I wasn't there in Sydney at the time. I left in May, and the Olympics were in September. So I wasn't in a good position to understand all of that. But there was a very radical Aboriginal activist, Ray Jackson, who I talked to a lot, and who was part of the Anti-Olympic Alliance, and he was predicting 10,000 protesters, including a big chunk of Aboriginal protesters, and something happened, and so the protest was just in the number of hundreds, not thousands. But it was a success in the sense that the media covered it. We were out there with placards, and within the limits of the draconian legislation about assembly and marches, our side did our best.
I'm sure a lot of you know we're going to have an Olympic heading block on this site at Britannia. We're going to be using the stadium that was happening. I don't know. I just wanted your certainly done some research, but Helen and Anna, what's your sense of right at the site of the venues? What security and surveillance is going to look like from what you understand, and then what you think that that's going to be?
Yeah, I imagine it'll be as bad as you think it will be, or worse. But vast areas would be cordoned off and patrolled and so on. In the case of Sydney, parts of the universities were taken over, the residences in the universities were taken over, and so students who one would think had a right to access to libraries and that kind of thing were going through a kind of patrolled area that was kind of off limits during the Olympics. So I imagine with the practice venue in your neighbourhood that they'll just block off bits. I'm also thinking of because Sydney sort of pioneered the draconian legislation in 2000, they had a World Youth Day last year, and they used that legislation that was still in place. It didn't just end with the Olympics leaving. They used it to try to ban pro-choice T-shirts during the Pope's visit. And it was the legislation said something about messages on T-shirts that are inappropriate or maybe unpleasant to others, or something that included every T-shirt that all of us wear, probably. And they tried passing that in the Parliament on a Friday afternoon, and there was such an outcry that the next week it was reversed, fortunately. But and then around the Randwick Racecourse, where the Pope had, where the World Youth Day young people did their overnight sleeping, and you know, the Pope addressed them and all that kind of thing, there was a metal fence about 20 feet high built around the residential, sometimes in a residential street, separating the north side from the south side of a residential street, blocking off people's garages and laneways, that kind of thing. It was incredible, but it was easy to do because they'd done the Olympics in the, with the same kind of approach. Of course, you may have seen on TV when they had the APEC conference there and in Sydney, there's a local television show called Chaser's War. It's totally irreverent and does kind of stunts, you know, political stunts. And they had a limo with a little Canadian flag on it. That was a nice touch. And they had one of their actors dressed up as Bin Laden. Like, literally, the beard, the white thing, you know. And they got to drive all the way down Macquarie Street, and they had their cameras running. And the security guards were saying, "Hi, mate, go on through." And they got, you know, within a short distance of where Bush was, George W. And they were wanting to get arrested. They showed a fake ID. And the cops and the security said, "Yeah, should be right, come on." Eventually they stopped. The actor dressed as Bin Laden got out of the car. And then they finally tweaked. Oh. So, but that's sort of an aside, a humorous aside. But, you know, security is going to be horrendous, yeah.
Well, one thing about that, with the canyon, that is like the RCMP have requested 40 kilometers of security fencing, and it's to have like, it's to have perimeter intrusion devices or detection devices on them and stuff. Like, they're not just fences, but they're kind of like a bit more to them, as well as hundreds of CCTV camera systems, which they're gonna put up these fencing and cameras around the Olympic venues and that. So even in Britannia, you know, could have security fencing around it and surveillance cameras set up.
In this context, what do you think is the best ways to attack the Olympics project?
In the short term, like Vancouver, or?
Like you want in the short term, you know, middle term, in the long term.
I think, what my recommendations that I read out at the end from my last book are probably the sort of short version of what to do to challenge the Olympic industry. And then, you know, with the Vancouver Olympics, you know, the visible presence of protesters, and there are always uncredentialed journalists who are looking for the story behind the story. And they're not necessarily sympathetic but or supportive, but they want to dish the dirt, really. And, you know, the more they can get their stories out internationally, the better. The sort of seamy underside that the mainstream isn't reporting. So.
Did you want to answer?
I was interested in what Helen had to say about the, you know, the attempt to influence school children and so on. In Vancouver, the school board actually has a very stringent policy against corporate intrusion into schools. But one of the things that's happening is VanOck and city bureaucrats and the corporations are pumping stuff in directly through teachers, completely ignoring what the regulations are in school board policy. So the school trustees, a lot of them would like to get copies of whatever is going in. So if any of you have students that you know, please ask them, you know, get copies of that stuff, make photocopies of it, turn it over to the school trustees because they're very anxious to try and maintain that policy for a lot of reasons, you know, not just the Olympics, but generally speaking, they don't want the corporate logos stamped all over everything in schools. And, you know, the Olympics are being used as a sort of a lever to crack that policy open.
Absolutely. The Royal Bank is responsible for something called Olympic education. And it's very easy to get on their mailing list, their email list. You just have to apply. I can, if you want to email me, I can forward all the information to you. So I get endless stuff, and it's all this Olympic facts and figures, rah, 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 the Olympics are wonderful, no critical stuff. And just at the best way of describing it is that it's just facts and figures. It doesn't promote critical thinking. It's just mindless stuff. But at worst, it's, as you say, indoctrination into a way of thinking about the Olympics and a way of thinking about corporate sponsors that's really very disturbing.
I'm wondering, in the research you've done, have you done a follow-up in the cities, in the venue cities, as to what happens, say, for instance, with public sector bargaining after all this money spent on the Olympics? For instance, in this province, governments went in 2006 in public sector bargaining. They called it the billion-dollar dangle, but they spent $1 billion to get contracts that normally would in 3 years to get them past the Olympics. In this province, all the major public sector unions, their contracts now expire March 30th, 2010. And they're going to claim poverty, we have the economic disaster and all this other kind of stuff, but also they're not going to have money because of the Olympics. They already spent $1 billion. Now, I don't mind that money going to working people, but they're obviously going to try and recoup it and play games after the Olympics. So what happened in other cities as far as public sector bargaining or job action, whatever, post the Olympics because of just not having any money?
Sorry, I don't know the answer to that. I know that... looking at Sydney 2000 or in the period lead up to Sydney 2000, some of the unions were very militant, some of them were sold out. It was a cross section, so, but I really can't answer that, I'm sorry.
The voice is kind of like that school, but I have a question and also a small announcement. For Gord, over the last few years, we've been hearing a lot at certain Olympic events and that about the police wanting not to have their pictures taken. And in Britain, they're bringing in some sort of legislation to try and prevent their photographs being taken. And what I was wondering, has any of that come up here yet? I'm assuming if it does, we need to cover up some of their crimes if they're just being forced against
I've not heard anything about any kind of that kind of legislation, and I regularly take photographs of police at our rallies and stuff, because they're like taking pictures of us and me, so I got some good photos of them with their cameras and their video cameras and stuff, and they don't seem to really care if we're taking photographs of them at this point, anyway. Although I see in Europe and that some of the police, when they come out into the streets, especially their riot police, always wear ski masks. So that's probably some psychological thing, but that would definitely embolden them to carry out criminal actions because they would it would be harder to identify them.
The announcement they have to is some friends and I got together a few years ago. We put together a fake Olympics tourist site, and this may be of use for anybody who wishes to either add to it. The site, it's basically a comedy site. There's nothing funny about the Olympics. It's probably one of the shittiest things to be dumped on. It approaches it in a comedy vein, and it leads up to a lot of the subjects we're being talked about here tonight. Now, it's primarily aimed at tourists, basically to give them an education when they're browsing through looking for information on tourism and the Olympics in Vancouver. Hopefully they'll stumble across us. And but it can be useful too, so we're going to throw our resources into the fray, hopefully help out someone. And I have are current. There are some at the back, if people want to make sure. We're up now.
Okay, we're running out of time, so I'm just going to do... There's three more people on the list, so if people could just keep their questions brief.
That question for Helen. My impression is that in the past there's been some acknowledgement of the problem of focusing only on the gold medal winners and putting some token effort into encouraging particularly children to participate in healthy activity and sport. However, recently there's been an intense focus on just winning gold. Is that your impression too? And is this something that comes and goes with the critique of that problem? Or do you know whether this is something that's kind of a recent refocusing on just winning?
Well, I know when Canada was in, the Canadian national team was in Beijing, I had journalists asking me, you know, everyone's tearing their hair out and saying, we're not winning medals, we're not spending enough money on medal winning strategies and that kind of thing. And I was saying, as much as I'm critical of the Olympics, I'm not going to say that a bronze medal winner is a nobody, or that even getting to Beijing was a non-event. If you're an athlete and you got to Beijing, you know, isn't that good enough for a start? But from another perspective, it was during the Atlantic Games that Nike had an ad, and it was to the effect that no one remembers the silver medalist's name, or so it was pithier than that because it was a nice marketing strategy. But that was the point of it. That
was that you don't win silver, you lose gold.
Probably. Yes, yeah. So, I don't think there's any kind of inverse relationship between physical educators protesting that and the swing towards re-establishing that theme. I think it just, you know, I don't think the promoters of the medal-winning strategies are paying a whole lot of attention to what physical educators and parents and community leaders might be thinking. Unfortunately, be nice if they did.
I was wondering what you thought of some strategies or forms of organization that have taken place in the last years here to, for example, like some camps instituted and perpetuated habitat by natives to protect the mountains. I don't know if I understand well what you said about the strategies that you were into being opted, like pacific actions, and I wonder like how it subscribes in like the actions that have taken place around here to protect the land, to protect its people, and what you think of the strategies, or what's your perspective on the actions that have taken place here in the last years?
Well, I'm not from here or part of here, so I don't want to speak presumptuous and say. Just as a kind of general comment, I think there's room in anti-Olympic movements for a whole spectrum of groups, political groups, strategies, philosophies, and so on. And when I was in Sydney, surprise to me, but I was actually sitting at a table talking about homelessness problems at a small meeting of a coalition next to a Salvation Army woman wearing her Salvation Army uniform, and that was the first time I'd ever sat at a table in that sort of context. So there was sort of Red Cross and Salvation Army who were initially, so they didn't all stay for the whole course, but initially part of this big coalition, and there were anarchists and direct action folks and the various Aboriginal groups. And there's, as I start to say, the short answer is I think there's room in community organising, or there should be in a big challenge of coalition building.
There's room for a whole spectrum, and the courageous people who do hunger strikes and direct actions help people like me who aren't going to do that, but who sit at the computer writing, doing interviews with journalists, that kind of thing, and, you know, less direct stuff. So a big spectrum of people coming from all angles and all political positions in public, expressing solidarity, working out our differences privately, you know, in meetings amongst our own, amongst like-minded people, not airing our differences for the other side to see and to then do the divide and conquer thing. But there are going to be differences. It's going to be difficult to work across all the diverse perspective, political perspectives. And I don't need to tell you that. It's, you know, probably part of your everyday experience here. So I think that's kind of summing up what I feel about it.
Last question?
Yeah, I just want to know how you came to the Olympic resistance and doing research about the Olympics.
Okay.
And more about your history about that subject.
Very, very briefly, I was asked how I came to be an Olympic, anti-Olympic activist. I began doing sports sociology in 1980 and did my PhD on women and sport. And I was very active as an advocate for women and sport. Throughout the 80s and 90s as an academic and joined local groups and national groups. In 1998, Toronto was organising against... Brenot Circuses was organising against Toronto's bid for the 2008 Olympics, and I bumped into a friend who I'd known through the women's sport work, who was a founding member of Brenot Circuses, and I started going to meetings, and the rest is history, because at the end, in December 1998, that was that big expose of the bribery in Salt Lake City and elsewhere involving IOC members, and so I began collecting research data for the first book and continued to be an active part of Brenot Circuses, so I documented my sort of insider perspective in the first book, and I did that in the others as well. So that's how I got to be.
What was the activism he was involved in?
Well, Brenot Circuses was a coalition similar to the Olympic Resistance Network here, but we organised at the bid stage, and we played a part, I'm sure, in the bid being unsuccessful, so we were winners. In terms of not getting the games twice. I wasn't involved with the first Brenot Circuses work, but I was involved from 1998 on for the second one. And we did, it was a loose coalition of homeless advocates and poverty advocates, environmental people, anarchist socialists, very similar cross-section to the group here. And We did the kind of education that you were talking about, you know, public forums like this, media work. We took part in labour rallies and International Women's Day rallies with banners, that kind of thing. And just tried to be an alternative voice to raise awareness, just as this group here is.
Thanks, everyone. Just quickly, I want to remind people, there's t-shirts for sale at the back. You can talk to Gord. There's a donations cup. It'd be great if you could put a couple dollars in there. There's a sign-up sheet if you want information on upcoming events. I think there's still a little bit of food left over. And again, just a final reminder of Torch March this Thursday, 6 p.m. at Victory Square. And most importantly, thank you so much, Gord and Helen.